Today's program was brought to you by Le Creuset, made in France since 1925. The first and finest enameled cast iron cookware and a favorite for generations. For more information, visit lecreuset.com. That's LECREUSET.com.
I'm HRN's Executive Director, Katie Mosman Wadler, with a preview of this week's episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup. This week, we're looking at the way labels shape our perspectives on food.
I know you're not supposed to judge a book by its cover, but is it acceptable to judge a wine by its label?
There are some labels that I'd say are so bad they're good.
As long as your paperwork's in good shape, you'll get a grass-fed label.
Tune in to this week's Meat and Three on Heritage Radio Network. That's Meat plus sign THREE. Available wherever you listen to podcasts. Hello, this is Lisa Held coming to you live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, and you're listening to The Farm Report, a Heritage Radio Network show about the people, processes, and policies that shape how food is produced today. So today I'm here with Dan Wilson. He's a farmer and co-owner of Hicks Orchard in upstate New York and a cider maker from Slyborough Cider House. Dan, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks, Lisa. It's great to be here.
So we've got a lot of shows on Heritage Radio this week hitting cider as a topic because it's Cider Week here in New York City. But I'm excited to have you because you are really involved in the orchard and, you know, the growing of the fruit that turns into cider, right? And then also the processing of and making of the cider. And you don't know this, but I am so excited for this conversation because I grew up in the Hudson Valley and apple orchards are definitely my happy place. And cider.
Mine too.
Yeah. Cider, I think, is like in my blood. I love it so much. So let's start out with the orchard. Mm. So I understand that Hicks Orchard has been around for more than a century. Is that right?
Yeah. As far as I know, the first trees were planted in the 1870s, 1880s. Wow. We still have some trees on the farm that are 100 years old. But we're planting a lot of new and, you know, high density small trees, too. So we have the full gamut. Some very old traditional varieties and some new varieties. And we're, you know, more and more planting varieties just for cider. Hicks Orchard has a distinction of being the oldest pick-your-own orchard in New York State. Hmm. So we've been inviting people to the farm since 1905. And
1905.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I heard some great stories of the reason that they started to do that was the local families that would build baskets for their cherry harvest had an argument with the family, and they weren't able to get packaging supplies. So in maybe a fit of inspiration, they decided to let people come into the orchard and pick their own. Huh. And that started a tradition. Over the years, Hicks Orchard was also a dairy farm, and they phased the dairy portion of the business out in the 1950s. And gradually turned more of their 90 acres of apples to pick your own. So when my family bought the farm in 1974, it had a very robust, pick your own business. And we would, see thousands of cars on a weekend day just to come and get their own fruit.
Yeah. Well, and you say your family bought the orchard in 1974. Your family as in your parents or?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So did you grow up on the
I started high school in the local town, Granville. Having grown up in Midwest and spent some time in Connecticut before this. My father was a food scientist, worked for General Foods, kind of took an early retirement, reinventing his life and moving to an orchard. My mom had grown up on a dairy farm, and she said, "I will follow you on this fantasy as long as there are no cows involved." She'd already done that. And so this is where we landed. It was a great fit. It took me a long time to decide to, come back to the farm and take it over for myself. Mm. And ran it with my wife for 20 years and all the way up until recently. And we started making cider in the early 2000s.
Okay.
Partly because it was a, you know, running a pick-your-own farm where our season is so highly condensed around the harvest.
Right.
And so we not only have to have a really great growing season, we have to have a really nice weather during the harvest. And, you know, 85 to 90% of our income would come on 6 weekends in a year.
That's crazy.
Which is kind of insane.
Yeah.
On top of all the risks and all the variables that you, you know, you're out of control with for a farm, cider seemed to make some sense. So in terms of the business structure of the farm, it was important because it gave us something that we could make from our fruit, and sometimes, you know, for less than perfect fruit, in a product that we could market year round, and we could market off the farm, and also kind of helped us to kind of jump into food and cuisine and culture and history, and give us some exposure to lots of different venues and demographics. So business wise, it made a lot of sense. We're also very interested in the creative aspect of cider because, you know, you're taking this great raw product and there's creativity involved in the making of the cider, the choices you make, how it's blended, how it's presented. At the time we started getting into cider, even though cider had a great history in the United States, it basically disappeared with Prohibition. You may have heard that story. So modern cider is only about 20 years old. So we're still trying to figure out where cider fits in the spectrum of everything you have available to drink for different occasions. But so there's this kind of feeling things out as we go, where cider fits, how to present it, whether it's really should be kind of presented as a wine or some kind of an alternative to beer, or both those things, or maybe something beyond that too.
Right.
So the creativity, the whole aspect of how we put the cider together, how we, you know, tied in with other people who are interested in food and drink. Those are really kind of exciting things. And so it kind of opened up our world in a lot of ways.
Right. Well, and when you talk about that moment when you decided to start making cider and add that to what the orchard was doing, how much of a transition was that for the actual farm operation? Because the apples are different, right? Mm-hmm. They're completely different varieties that you grow for cider. Is that right?
Well, yes and no. Mm-hmm. And so how cider exists in the world right now in the United States is the vast majority of cider is either made on the largest scale from apple juice concentrate, on the smaller regional scale or the mid-sized companies, they're using fresh apple juice that's locally sourced, which is great. But almost invariably, it's the surplus of the fresh apple industry.
Oh, okay.
So there are a lot of eating apples that are, you know, have no other home, and they end up as juice, and people are making cider out of them, and it's, you know, perfectly legitimate. I wouldn't say it's a problem, but a characteristic of a lot of those ciders is that they're really good as eating apples, but they don't really confer a lot of flavor to a hard cider. So that's where you kind of dig a little bit deeper and you find either great heritage apples from the United States that have a lot more flavor, a little more kind of robust quality, or we kind of look at other cider cultures from England or France or Spain, where they've been continuously growing and developing cider fruit for centuries, basically. So then as we get access to these apple varieties, we're putting these in the ground, and this is where you get a lot of interesting complexity with cider that's inherently built around the qualities of the apples. So in some ways, to answer your question, then, cider is, we look for apples that have a great, you know, natural flavor that translates well into a hard cider. Not all the cider that's out there is made that way. But again, the industry is young. We're still trying to learn as we go, to try to educate, you know, the customers so that to encourage them to kind of explore cider and to find what they like. And hopefully really become intrigued by, you know, these unique qualities of cider that really you can't find in a wine or a beer.
Yeah. So are you right now growing all the apples that you use for your cider?
Nearly all the apples. We do have some other local sources of fruit, but the really highly unusual varieties of classes of apples called bittersweet or bitter sharp apples, those are very rare. And while my trees are young and we're a year or so away from production on those, I do find some others from local or regional farms.
How long does it take for a tree to start producing apples? Like you said, they're young and they're not producing yet. How long is that process from when you plant them?
Well, it's a long term. So basically, if you put a tree in the ground, and we're growing these as young trees and not from seeds,
okay,
because we want true varieties. We have to graft onto a rootstock to get a variety to be predictable. So once we plant a tree, it really depends on the orchard that you design, because you can choose trees that will have a rootstock that will support a tree of a certain size.
Okay.
So right now, most growers are planting dwarf or semi-dwarf trees, and what causes the dwarfing is the rootstock, because it will only grow to a certain point. It will only provide the nutrient system for a tree of a certain size. Mm. So a semi-dwarf tree can grow up to 20 feet tall probably, it will take maybe 5 or 10 years for that to come into full production.
Wow.
A very small tree is basically like growing the branch instead of growing the whole tree. You're not focused on growing the structure of the tree. You're trying to get it into production as soon as possible. And with good management, you can do that in 3 or 4 years.
Okay, but that's still a pretty long time before you can...
And to back up from that, too, is when we order trees from a nursery, they don't have a big, backlog of trees that you can just say, I want 4 of these or, 500 of these. You have to build that order 2 years in advance.
Wow.
So you contract with a nursery. Design the trees you want. The rootstock, match to the scion wood that you need, assuming they can get that for some of these unusual varieties. And then you wait 2 years, and you do all the ground prep, and then put the trees in the ground another 3 years or so, maybe a little longer depending on, seasonal variability. And then you have a tree that will produce fruit. As we make cider, we're kind of learning that, as with wine grapes, it takes a little while for the tree to settle down into full quality apples that will, be the best for cider. So maybe even another couple of years beyond that before you get the best cider from those apples.
Interesting. What about the landscape? Because I think being in New York, we assume that it's a great place for apples. Right?
We
have a lot of apples, lots of orchards. But I'm curious if the climate, how it affects what you can grow and the kinds of apples that you grow. And I've also heard, and this is sort of like through the grapevine, we're talking about cider, I shouldn't.
Easy trap to fall into.
Sorry. But, I've heard that it's actually pretty tricky to maintain orchards without, in terms of pest management in New York, that it can be really tricky. It can be really tricky. Can you talk a little bit about, New York as a climate and how it affects your growing?
Growing organically is really tough, regardless of the crop. One of the problems with growing apples organically in New York State is we not only have a great climate for growing apples, we have a great climate for many different kinds of insects that like apples, and by, probably more importantly, diseases. There's the most common disease for apples is a fungal disease called scab, and it literally kind of produces scab lesions on the skin. If they're too bad, then it kind of deforms the fruit as it grows, and they'll crack and kind of be unusable. Different varieties of apples have different susceptibility or resistance to scab, too. The majority of organic apples that are consumed in the country are grown in dry climates, like Washington State, where they don't have the fungal disease pressure that we have. So that makes it challenging. It's not impossible to grow apples organically in New York State. It just adds a lot to the complex set of issues you have to deal with to grow good fruit. We are an IPM grower, integrated pest management. We work closely with Cornell, with different organizations nationally and internationally to design models for us to have more predictability for how insects and diseases pressures build during a season. Mm. We do a lot of on-farm monitoring, and that kind of gets us to a point where we can spray the softest materials with the least frequency and the lowest active rates that will give us the benefit of those products. And we really try to stay on top of that so that we can have a minimal spray program.
Right.
It is challenging, and we work really hard to keep that to a minimum. Every year is a little different. Different things come up. There are new invasive species of insects that we have to kind of now pay attention to also. So it's a changing landscape always.
Right.
But one of the reasons that we're planting small trees, these high density orchards, is that they require a lot less input. The smaller target of a tree that's only, will grow to be 2.5 feet wide and maybe 10 feet tall. You have to use a lot less material in terms of pesticides and fertilizers and other things too.
Interesting. Hmm. Another thing I just thought of in terms of just like food system issues and orchards is it occurs to me that if you're making cider, from apples, there might be a lot less waste in terms of apples. Like, is that something that you have come across? A lot of people are talking about food waste right now. And I would imagine like when you harvest apples for cider, you can kind of use them all, right? Whereas,
it does give us a lot more range on what we can use. Mm-hmm. For example, the use of apples that fall on the ground, we're not able to use those for a fresh cider. Mm-hmm. We have a food safety program for our fresh cider business. The act of fermenting a product with the production of alcohol is actually it's a sanitizing product or process for the fresh juice. That's one of the reasons the pioneers were taught to make hard cider because it was
absolutely
safer to drink than the surface water that most people had access to.
Yeah.
So by killing E. coli, by deactivating patulin, which is a natural carcinogen, which is a food safety concern. That gives us the ability to use fruit that we would otherwise not be able to use. We're mm-hmm. still careful to sort the apples, make sure that we're not using anything that's broken open or rotted or anything like that. Partly for that issue, but also just because it's produces a lower quality juice.
Right. Yeah. Right. Mm. So I've asked you lots of questions about the orchard farming. We're going to take a break in a minute, and then when we come back, we're going to talk more about the actual process of making the cider, and we're going to taste some cider, which I'm really excited about. So we're just going to take a short break. We'll be right back.
Program was brought to you by Le Creuset, the first to pioneer colorful enameled cookware over 90 years ago. They've been a favorite for generations through the meals and memories the cookware creates and the style it expresses. My name is Kat Johnson. I'm the communications director at Heritage Radio Network. When I'm not making food radio, I'm making food, and my favorite cookware is the 8-quart marine blue Dutch oven that never leaves my stovetop. Before we got our Le Creuset, the cookware we used most often was an antique Griswold cast iron pan. It didn't take long for me to realize how much I'd been missing enamel cast iron in my life. Le Creuset has the superior heat retention of cast iron, but paired with the unparalleled performance and ease of enamel. That means delicious food with easy cleanup. Head to lecreuset.com/HRN, that's lecreuset.com/HRN, to see all the new products and amazing holiday gift deals. HRN listeners will get 20% off the new Le Creuset cookbook with the code HRN.
All right, this is Lisa Held. We're back. You're listening to the Farm Report on Heritage Radio Network. I'm here with Dan Wilson from Slyboro Cider and Hicks Orchard, and we're talking about cider. And I think the best way to start off this second part is let's drink some.
Let's drink some cider.
So while you're opening them, can you tell us what you brought?
Sure. We were talking about unusual apple varieties. This first one is a Kingston Black, which is unusual for a couple of reasons. One is that it's a still cider. Most ciders that are in the market are sparkling.
Okay.
This is a still cider. We wanted to kind of create a cider that really, you know, explored this great apple. But also we wanted to make a cider that wine drinkers could understand. This is, I think, a little more savory in quality. There's a fair amount of tannin in the Kingston Black apple. But there's still a lot of fruit in the flavor. It's almost like fruit without the sweetness of fruit. In some ways, but a kind of a nice, darker, earthy kind of background to it. Last night at an event, we were pairing these with dumplings, and it was like Asian, slightly spiced dumplings, and they were it was a great, great, exploration of how cider pairs really well, nicely with umami and kind of those kind of chewier qualities.
It really has a lot of wine qualities, right? Like that, it's really interesting. It's delicious. And so you talk a little bit, I've read a little bit about, you know, your approach to cider making. You describe on your website, you say you go back to the lost craft of traditional American ciders. Can you talk a little bit about what that means? Like, what's your process and how does it compare to how other ciders are made?
I think we were taught by other cider makers that we were in collaboration with early on that cider, you know, rightfully is a winemaking process. We're basically making white wine with apples, and we're using the same processes, the same, in some cases, the same yeast, the same equipment as a white wine winery. We're also, as apple growers, we're dealing with kind of a sense of vintage. So it's not just the variety, but which varieties produce certain, you know, higher quality sugar or acidity in a particular year, and how that will translate into the cider that comes out of that. Yeah, on our farm, one of the first things we did when I developed my little mad scientist room, as my wife called it, with all the bubbling carboys of cider, was we tested for ourselves this general notion that not all apples produce good cider. We didn't want to take it on face value. We wanted to kind of see that ourselves. And in some ways, in our exploring cider in the region, we found that some of those, the common wisdom is not always true. For example, in our experiments, a common eating variety, kind of a classic American variety, Cortland, we could not get a very good cider from that. It was always pretty insipid.
I love Cortland.
Cortlands
so
are
good.
Great to eat. But if you go up to Canada, there are some really fabulous ciders made from Cortland. So, it gives you a little sense that, you know, it's not just this blanket truth that certain apple varieties will not produce good cider. It could get to, and I'm kind of looking forward to where we may be in a couple of decades, where we really get a sense of not just which apples make good cider, but which regions grow certain apples more with more character or kind of regional quality.
Right.
We're not there yet. So, we did this experimenting with all the apple varieties we could get our hands on, what we could grow, what we can have access to, and kind of reinvent that palette for ourselves. And so that was kind of rediscovering the lost tradition of cider.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, a little different than the ciders that are, you know, mostly out in the world and that are, a little sweeter and fruitier and friendly and approachable. But we were hoping for something with a little more character that also was really grew naturally out of our farm and our interest.
Mm. Well, and that parallel with winemaking is so interesting. We were just in Virginia with Heritage Radio this past weekend, and I did some tastings with Virginia winemakers, and they're growing, for instance, they're growing a lot of Bordeaux variety grapes in Virginia and making these Bordeaux style wines that are amazing. But they don't taste, you know, the Bordeaux from Virginia doesn't taste like a Bordeaux from, you know, from France. And that's,
isn't that a great thing?
And it's a great thing. I mean, they were amazing wines, and you don't expect it to, that sort of makes sense, right? Yeah. And so that idea that a Cortland apple, you know, cider made from a Cortland in Canada wouldn't necessarily be the same as one in New York, it does make intuitive sense when you think of it that way, right? But we just haven't really thought about cider that way before.
No, we haven't. And of course, every growing season is different. On hot, dry summers, especially late in the summer, the apples will be a little smaller, but the sugars will be condensed and higher. And so that we kind of look to that to again, translate into certain qualities of the hard cider that those will make. It's almost like with a vineyard, how when they're again grown in a drying climate, and they manage their drought. You know, they'll irrigate trees or vines early in the season, but let them get stressed toward the end of the growing season, so that it kind of helps to build that kind of quality in the wine grapes. Same's true with apples. So, you know, they are kind of, the living part of the process, which is really interesting. Mm-hmm. And so every year is different, and we're trying to learn and kind of deepen that knowledge base each year.
Right. What are some of your favorite varieties of New York apples to make cider with?
Yeah, well, you were talking about how New York State is a great apple-growing state. And one of the reasons it's different from other apple-growing regions is we have a lot of older traditional orchards. So we do have access to a wider variety of varieties than, you know, Washington State, which is, you know, the real giant in the country for growing apples. They have this monstrous pipeline of juice that many cider makers out there use. But so, in my opinion, most of the cider there tastes very similar. There are some really good cider makers out there, so I certainly won't disparage too much.
I'll have to have someone from there on to... Yeah.
I can recommend some, too, so I'll tell you a good starting place. But so New York State has great traditional varieties, actually some really good cider varieties that are inherent to New York State. Like Golden Russet. Mm. Really nice eating apple. Not too common, but you find them in orchards in different places. This year, our Golden Russet produced a really high sugar juice. It has a really beautiful acidity. There's some really nice kind of spiciness that comes through in the hard cider. So that's just kind of a natural. Another cider variety, which is again from New York State, is Asapa Spitzenberg. It's kind of a high acid apple, which also is kind of a nice component to a cider. And then in modern times, there's a variety called Liberty, which was developed out of the Geneva apple breeding program. And it was initially introduced as a variety that was naturally resistant to scab, the disease we talked about earlier. And so it was thought that would be, you know, kind of find its place in the market as a low spray variety. We planted an acre of those and didn't find too many of those customers, but then found that they make a really nice cider. Huh. So, looking back in history, but also in modern times, there are more and more apples that we're looking for certain flavor notes or certain qualities. The Geneva associated with Cornell out in Western New York, there's an apple breeding program that for years and years has been focused on developing the new hot, you know, breed of apple for the fresh market. But we have talked to the breeders there, and we say, you know, there are these orchards full of apples that you're kind of bypassing because they don't fit that bill. But now, you know, within, you know, last several years, we've been experimenting with those as, you know, for the potential for hard cider.
Right.
So, you know, we're working on developing new varieties. varieties that will not, you know, just give the good quality to cider, but some of these traditional cider varieties are hard to grow. They can be heavily biennial or have, you know, very prone to certain diseases. So if we can meet the happy medium of really interesting cider flavors from these varieties in an easy to grow apple that's annually bearing and easy to manage, and maybe has some disease resistance, that would be, you know, that would be kind of a triple play. So
yeah,
the search continues. There are a lot of apple orchard or cider makers that are using feral apples, that are using wild apples in their fruit or in their ciders. It's a different model, but it it allows them to, you know, find fruit that does have a lot of you know, great flavor characteristics that and make use of some fruit that, you know, would otherwise go to waste.
Right. Yeah, that's really cool. Should we try the other one?
Okay, let's do that.
Pop it open.
This one is called La Santerre, and it is a semi-sweet sparkling cider that... Oh, didn't get much of a pop.
I thought it was going to be a
nice...
It's
going to be really dramatic. So this is a primary part of the base cider is golden russet. And it has a certain kind of nice spiciness to that flavor. We do ferment some Macintosh, which is not normally thought of as a good cider apple. But we find that a fully ripe Macintosh that is fermented, the interesting single note that it contributes is a really nice kind of floral quality in the nose. So for that reason, there's some Macintosh, and there's some bittersweet because we wanted a little bit of kind of that structure and the back end of the flavor. And then before bottling it, we add ice cider, which is it's a different process. It's like an ice wine made from apples.
Wow!
And so that's a process that was developed in Quebec as a kind of an adjunct to the ice cider industry that they built there. Rather than letting the fruit freeze on the trees, though, we take fresh cider pressed in the middle of winter. We predict when, or we look at the weather map and find the coldest part of the winter, press a bunch of cider, put it outside to let it freeze naturally.
Oh, you let the cider itself freeze.
Yeah, we let the cider freeze. And then as it starts to thaw, it's the high sugar portion of the juice that drains away first, leaving most of the volume behind as kind of a flavorless ice. So it turns out to be a super high sugar, high flavor must, basically. And then we partially ferment that. We ferment it as slowly as we can. And then cold stabilize the tanks, refreezing the wine before it's finished to retain a lot of the natural sweetness. So we contribute a good portion of that to the La Santerre to give it a lot of the great flavor notes, some kind of baked apple quality, and some kind of nice melon things, almost a little bit of pineapple that comes through with that. And then, you know, all the sweetness there is to kind of naturally from the apple.
It's really delicious. And so that's really interesting. I mean, that's like a very complex
it
process.
It is complex, yes.
And it's
we put so much into these ciders. It's crazy.
And it's sort of a blend, I guess, you know, of different apples in that one. Are most of the ciders that you make, do they involve lots of different apples in one cider?
The way we normally work on at Slyborough is we make single variety batches of cider as much as we can. There are some apples that are, they need to be blended before fermenting because they're maybe not very acidic. And to have a safe, you know, predictable fermentation, we want to make sure we have the acidity within a certain range.
Okay.
But for the most part, we like to ferment single variety batches to total dryness, and then we blend at the end to kind of build the different flavors we're looking for. Beyond that, we're kind of starting to work now with some barrel aging of ciders. And from the beginning also, we wanted to present ciders that kind of expressed a full range of flavors just to demonstrate what you could do with apples. That's why we have ciders that are dry and still on the one end of the spectrum through several sparkling ciders and then up to ice cider, which is kind of the other extreme, just to kind of explore and experiment, but also to give us more of a palette to work with in building ciders.
Yeah. It's really amazing all the different things that you're doing with apples.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about the business side. I mean, it's just really interesting how many orchards have started making cider in New York, right?
Yeah. Well, in New York, it actually has the highest number of cideries of any state in the country. I think we're above 90 now.
Wow. Mm. And so you, people can still come to Slybro, right, and taste the cider and drink it, like, at Hicks Orchard. Is that right?
Yeah.
And then I know you're selling online on Cider and Love as well.
Yeah.
So tell me about that, like the economic model. Is it important that you get the cider out to more people?
Of course.
Did getting on Cider and Love change your business and that you're now able to get it out to a wider audience? Are you selling it in stores as well? Like, how did all that come about?
Yeah, our distribution kind of grew organically from operating a tasting room and doing some self-distribution in our neighborhood to getting to the point where we were confident that we could to expand to, you know, supply other markets.
Okay.
And so now we have a distributor that's kind of trying to get us good placements through New York State. And it's a kind of a work in progress, partly because distributors tend to be either beer distributors or wine distributors. Mm. And when cider is kind of hovers between the two, and we present ciders to kind of live in both markets, it's trying to find the right fit to educate the salespeople to know how to present things in different venues is kind of key. Cider and Love has been a great step forward for us because... also, I guess because of the rules and regulations, we cannot ship or we can't send by UPS cider if it's under 7% alcohol.
If just it's under.
Yeah, it is. You can send wine over the over by common carrier, and not the post office, but okay. It gets really complicated. Wow. I'll try to avoid getting in the weeds here. Cider and Love was a kind of a brilliant idea to create a central marketplace for wine style ciders. Mm. So heritage ciders that are in every case built around some of these really interesting, unique quality apples from different farms. And it's only the marketplace. So ciderandlove.com is the is the website, and it's kind of a curated selection of small, mostly farm-based cideries around the country that are presenting cider as a form of wine. And so you order through the website, but the individual farm fulfills the order, so you're actually buying directly from the farmer. And or the orchardist, as we,
right,
or the cider maker.
Yeah.
It's kind of important because we are trying to build this market. We're trying to create a venue for people to experiment and explore with cider. They're not everywhere, you know. I think in an ideal world, you would go into any wine shop, and there would be a cider section, you know, not just a couple bottles here and there, but a well-developed and curated section. In some areas, we're getting to that place, and wine buyers are starting to understand that. Wine writers are starting to understand that, and hold cider to the same kind of level of standards that they do with wine. And I think that's totally legitimate.
Yeah.
And it's only through doing that kind of work that we really start to build a market for ciders that really kind of command that respect.
Right. Well, and going back to the idea of the farm-based cideries, and you know, you were talking earlier about how when you were just a UPIC orchard, you were dependent on this like 6 weeks of income, right?
Yeah.
And I know it's just, I mean, as a small farm of any kind, it's really hard to make, you know, the economics work, right?
Yeah.
And you know, you're doing it with an orchard where this is like really short season, and then you got into cider making and you're growing it through all these different platforms. I mean, from your experience, do you think, is making cider a really good path for like farms, orchards? We're really going back and forth between these farm and orchard terms. Is it a good path for the owners of orchards who are like struggling with the economics to start making cider as a way to kind of make.
So I think we've been doing UPIC for a long time, and we're still a small, family scale farm. And the only reason we've been able to stay that way is because we've been able to be our own middle person. We have the direct connection to the final consumer of that product. So whereas most apple growers that are in the commercial scale, they are reliant on brokers to sell their fruit, and they have to sell at a kind of a lower wholesale cost. So any farmer that's interested in getting into cider, I think has to have the same approach, that it is not just making the cider and putting it in the world. It is, especially working on a small scale, it's developing some kind of a way of retailing the cider to get the full value of that the investment in you have in each bottle, because that's where, working on a small scale makes sense. Mm-hmm. It's doing farmers markets. It's having relationships with restaurants and bars to kind of help you to build a business, and especially working in your own neighborhood, because it's where I think you get the best the best possibility. When we first started, we were working with economic models for how to do a small winery, and. The Cornell put out a model for small wineries a long time ago. I spent a lot of time poring over that, and there was getting up to like a 5,000 case a year price point where you're retailing everything through your tasting room was a very profitable model. The next scale up, assuming you've kind of saturated that market, is to get to 20,000 cases. Because then you have to not only build more infrastructure, you're working with distributors and selling at a lower price point. So it's a big jump between 5,000 and 20,000 before you start to increase your profitability. Huh. So I guess that's a little long-winded way to say. Yes, it can work for farms. It can work for cider makers, but start small and really work on building the relationships, being a marketer as much as a cider maker.
Mm. Perfect. So before we go, what's next for Slyboro?
Well, we're waiting for these great trees to come into full production and scaling up. We are launching a line of canned ciders, and that's a different story, with some twists and turns. For Slyboro, we're coming out with a bottle-conditioned dry version of the La Santerre, which is phenomenal. Mm. And as I said, we're doing some barrel-aged ciders, which also are going to kind of bring it up a notch. As we have more access to fruit and time to work with them, we'll just kind of continue to try to put out really unique ciders.
Amazing. Mm. Well, thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Lisa. Appreciate it.
Thank you all so much for listening to the Farm Report on Heritage Radio Network. If you enjoyed the conversation, please subscribe to the podcast, rate, and share it. We'll see you next Wednesday.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.